You're listening to the Today in Manufacturing podcast.
Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me this week are Jeff Ranke and Anna Wells. We each have more than 15 years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we take the five most popular stories on our websites and discuss the implications they have on the industry going forward. Before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. You can email the podcast. You can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to our daily newsletter and subscribe to us on YouTube at IEN Magazine so you can join us live every Thursday. Jeff, a little bit tardy today because not our fault. Just our internet provider has just continued to fail us today.
Yeah, I was anticipating you asking me how I was feeling, and I was going to say relieved that we finally got this, because there is no greater exercise in patience than dealing with this type of customer service interaction, because you know it is not that person's fault, mm-hmm. but you still want to yell at them.
Yeah, I was really encouraged to see that we have the same on hold face, because I was walking over to your desk and I'm just like, I know what that is. That man is frustrated, on hold, and getting ready to kill somebody with kindness.
Yeah, it was, like I said, it makes no sense to go off on that individual. It is not their fault, their issue, whatever. But boy, you just want to so bad sometimes.
Yeah, and it's crazy, Anna, how as we hear how customer service is coming back in the whole white glove perspective in terms of being a differentiator, it's just not that case with everybody.
Did you feel like you got the white glove treatment?
They were very friendly.
Yeah.
But it still seemed to take longer than it should. Like, it wasn't a real complex issue to deal with.
Yeah.
Especially because it needed to be addressed twice.
Yeah.
In about 4 hours.
Yeah, we didn't hit the button that we said we had to hit last time.
Yeah.
But at least, Anna, it is a reminder of the innovative spirit of our office, in that regardless of what sort of, you know, what sort of trouble we may face, we can always rally together and come up with some sort of game or sport based on the limited tools at our disposal.
Yeah, that's true. You did put together some quick, like, office Olympics.
Yeah.
Like seconds.
Yeah.
Like, the internet was out and you guys turned into a seventh grade gym class in less than 30 mm-hmm. seconds.
Exactly. You know, it's pretty good. It's, you know, like walking into that old gymnasium where you just have that corner full of random implements and you're like, we can work with this. We can work with this. All right. And, you know, congratulations to Ben and Alex as the, you know, first champions of office garbage bag. What is it?
Garbage bag?
Garbage can bags? Trash bags.
Trash bags.
Yes. Office trash bags, inaugural champions, Ben Munson and Alex Shanahan. But that title will fall. All right. Well, before we get started with our first story this week, we have a word from our sponsor, BigCommerce. Provides modern e-commerce technology that works with your existing systems. ERP, OMS, CRM, no problem. Whatever existing business tools and technologies you use today, BigCommerce can integrate using pre-built one-click integrations or customize your automation with its APIs. Make the move to BigCommerce today. Our first story this week. Gas leaked from bad fitting in Pennsylvania chocolate factory explosion. On March 24th, employees at the R.M. Palmer plant smelled gas before a powerful explosion killed 7 people, hospitalized 10 others, and severely damaged several properties in West Reading, Pennsylvania. This week, NTSB safety investigators traced the blast to a natural gas leak coming from a defective fitting. The NTSB found 2 leaks: a small one from a natural gas fitting installed in 2021, and another that was traced to a fractured gas fitting that was installed in 1982. The older fitting was manufactured by DuPont, but was known to crack. In fact, in 2007, the feds added the fitting to a list of pipe materials with, quote, poor performance histories. Still, they left it in place during utility work 2 years ago. Safety investigators determined that UGI, which provided natural gas to the factory, replaced a service line at the plant in 2021, but kept the 1982 service part connected to the system and fully pressurized. While the fitting is the likely cause of the explosion, the NTSB still hasn't made any conclusions. Anna, this is just a case, another case of kind of shoddy parts really making a, causing a big problem.
Yeah, shoddy parts, I think, is one part of the issue here. You know, as you mentioned, that older fitting that had a known tendency to crack and was added to that list of poor performance histories in 2007, you kind of wonder how that information, which is so critical, is actually getting into the hands of these factories. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at the average factory and turnover, and this is a long period of time, and you know, who installed it, who's, you know, who's absorbing this information and applying it within the plant, it just seems like a process that could potentially be full of holes. To me, the scariest consideration when you think about that is how much more of this old product is out there elsewhere.
Yeah, you just
don't know, right? And with that said, I think we need to acknowledge that these kinds of misses are going to continue to take place. Like, there will always be degradation and bad components and poorly installed ones. And so maintenance best practices and tracking of equipment history need to be addressed, but also they need to be paired, I think, with modern tools that are serving as kind of a second line of defense there. These types of plants should be equipped with gas detection equipment, so the decision whether or not to evacuate is not one person's judgment call.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's not a component you can miss. That's something everyone can have right now.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, to me, it can provide the data that you need. That's like a baseline, you know, that's showing like the toxic or dangerous levels of something. And then the facility should be evacuated. I think that these cases where people are left in harm's way, we tend to want to blame the managers. You know, people are complaining, but their complaints are kind of, you know, like you have to, as a manager, evaluate, like, you know, how strong is the smell? How many people are complaining? Like, how serious should we take that? And I do think that many managers are in a way conditioned because of the culture to make the most conservative decision when it comes to productivity. Mm-hmm. And when they are conditioned to roll the dice in a scenario like this because of the expense in productivity during your busy season, which mm-hmm. it was, okay. right? That's a systematic problem with the culture in many manufacturing environments. And I think we need to acknowledge that, where every tiny productivity metric is tracked, yep. and maybe their bonuses are tied to it, right? So those factors, consciously or not, may influence how they respond. And do I think we need to hold these people accountable? Yes, but they also need those tools in place that are purely objective tools, mm-hmm. And can maybe take them out of that decision-making process for scenarios like this, where the safety risk is a speculation based on reports of a smell or something, yeah. right? Or in the case of that tornado at Mayfield, mm-hmm. you know, that was perceived risk. That manager made the wrong choice. But say you had a way to take that manager out of the picture and you had a very defined plan of how that situation was to be managed, a strict policy on response, you know, then that decision can be made for you. And maybe you take some of that variability out.
Mm-hmm. And also, you know, making the, I guess, conservative decision in the Mayfield case as well, where it's just like you kind of bet like it's probably not going to hit us. Jeff, talking about some of these tools, I guess I'm still surprised that with these modern digital tools that we have at our disposal, there are still so many plants and even major players like RM Palmer, which is, you know, the only brand you see on the shelves at Easter, which is what they were kind of gearing up for that holiday season. It's kind of shocking that, I mean, maybe they do have these tools and it just didn't catch this faulty component.
Unfortunately, it's not shocking. I think that's the sadder part of this. And, you know, first of all, I'm still always kind of blown away too when the NTSB is involved in these investigations.
Yeah.
Transportation Safety Board.
Yeah. Far-reaching.
I think that's part of potentially the issue we have and trying to cut down on these types of incidents. I don't know. The one thing, you know, Anna mentioned it too, with a lot of the sensor technology. I think one of the things that we talk about when we talk about software, in particular, computerized maintenance management software, CMMS, there's always, there they can be that challenge of what's the return on investment for this type of platform? What do we get? What's the payback here? Because like Anna was alluding to, it's productivity. It's setting those types of goals. It's hitting your KPIs and all those types of things. Well, if you ever needed a case study for investing in a CMMS, here it is.
Yeah.
You have to think with predictive and preventative algorithms embedded within this software, it would have identified the fact that, hey, this part has been in use for 40 years.
Yeah.
Okay. There's also been issues with it performing in the past. All of this could have been put in through a historian section of this software and helping provide these types of reminders for maintenance managers of this facility. Even if they didn't want to pay attention to it, they would almost be forced to with a lot of the capabilities of the software. I think a lot of the times we talk about, you know, the machine whispers a little bit in terms of all that organic information that they have, and they just know what to do and they have a feel for things around the facility. Well, in this case, if that was the situation where maybe there was an understanding, this person moved on, whatever the case is, it wasn't documented. There was nothing there to help the replacement, or being a human being, we forget stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why you write it down. That's why you log it and you have information continually coming at you to make good decisions. So I think that was the biggest thing that I took away from this. If you want to hear us talk about the culture and the leadership issues at this facility, you can go back about a month. It's in the archives and you can hear us there. But that was my biggest takeaway.
I was surprised. See, I was kind of curious about whether or not sort of that tribal knowledge might have been a problem here. Just because I hear that a part is from 1982. And I don't know. I think maybe just best practice, it should have been replaced.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe it's one of those that it never cracked before. And so kind of why replace it? Because the other part that was leaking was a part from 2021. So my initial reaction to this was like, wow, they just don't make them like they used to, because the part from 1982 was leaking, but so was the part from 2021.
Well, and I would argue it's hard to, if you're working with any type, and Anna, you can talk about this, if you're working with any type of MRO distributor and they hear about a bad part or a recalled part or there's issues, if they know how to sell anything, they're going to be talking to you and saying, hey, just a heads up, you might want to replace this, and it just so happens we can help you with that.
Yeah.
And again, if that's logged and forgotten about or written down on a piece of paper and not mentioned, there's a difference there. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, continues with my argument, I guess.
Palmer and UGI are cooperating with the investigation. Multiple lawsuits have been filed by workers and their families. And to me, this bad fitting just seemed like a real smoking gun, even though the NTSB kind of stopped short of saying that that was the absolute root cause. Mm-hmm. It's just not possible to me, because a lot of people, particularly, and I get it because, you know, they're the ones suing the companies. But to me, they were blaming them, saying that they knowingly left this defective part installed. And I just can't believe that anyone in good conscience would leave a defective part on a gas line. You know, like, I mean, I get it if it's, I mean, maybe I'm being too altruistic, but like, not a mission critical component like that. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right. Well, our next most popular story. Sawmill owner refuses safety fixes after young worker perishes in accident. On January 11th, 2023, a 21-year-old employee who had been on the job for less than a month was being trained at the Missouri Mats Sawmill in Brashear, Missouri. He was fatally injured when he became ensnared in the vertical edger blades of a hurdle saw. Investigators told Gibson to protect employees from amputation hazards and report back when the safety hazard had been corrected. The inspectors returned 2 months later and found that Gibson not only failed to implement new safety measures, but had workers operating the saw as if nothing ever happened. Inspectors also found that Missouri Mats knew sawmill operators let the vertical edger continue to spin while inspecting the machine. Still, the company didn't retrain employees to use the machine safely or change the SOP. This machine is large enough to cut full-size logs, and the company makes wood products for various industries. OSHA placed an imminent danger notice on the saw, which is only used in extreme safety cases, and the owner finally fixed the safety feature. or the safety failure. OSHA has been placed, OSHA has placed Missouri Mets in the Severe Violator Enforcement Program and cited the company for more than 50 safety and health violations. The company faces nearly $350,000 in proposed penalties. During the investigation, OSHA also witnessed underage workers operating heavy-powered industrial trucks and kind of gave a heads-up to the wage division. Unfortunately, this isn't the first time a company helmed by Gibson failed to comply with federal workplace safety laws. In 2012, OSHA investigated a death at a logging site operated by Gibson, as well as a sawmill he owned in Arbella, Missouri. Anna, we talk about a host of these problems all the time, right? A lack of lockout, tagout, problems that we see with the culture, just systematic bad actors. And it seems like this story in particular, a lack of training or unqualified people operating this machinery. And this was just a perfect storm of all of those elements.
All of them. You know, as you mentioned, when OSHA returned to Missouri Mats to see if Mr. Gibson, who's the owner, I believe, of the facility, yes, had implemented those changes, that's when they saw that there was all those younger workers under 18 employed at the sawmill, and they're operating, you know, heavy equipment.
Yeah, using the saw in the exact same way.
Mm-hmm. So clearly, I mean, that says a couple things, right? As you said, this perfect storm of problematic behavior and culture, but also fearlessness on behalf of the owner of this company who, you know, as he's in the midst of this investigation, is still kind of trotting out these kids that aren't even legally allowed to work there.
Right.
And I want to add, too, that it's not just this edger that we discussed that was the problem here. You mentioned the multiple violations. As if this saw problem wasn't enough on its own, the agency pointed to unguarded holes that were fall hazards, no guardrails, no fire extinguishers, no PPE, lacks of labels on chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
That's not just one mistake.
No, I started listing all 53 and it just got to be a little much.
Well, it was, you know, I think it's important to point out a couple because it kind of brings, you know, it to light what these issues are, and the safety violations are like really, really basic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't have hearing protection. They didn't have glasses on. The fact that there's no labels on these chemicals is horrifying. What are you doing? People getting fall in a hole.
Like, well, yeah, really? Exposure to live wires.
Yeah, exposure to live wires. They said that people were not using ladders properly, like, or ladders are being used improperly. So who knows, you know, just how easy it would be to get injured in this place. And, you know, if you look at Brashear, mm-hmm, Missouri, it appears to be kind of a depressed region. The average household income is around $39,000. 15% of residents living in poverty compared to about 11% nationally. It's losing people. There's been a 17% population decline since the year 2000. And I think you often see that with areas that lack opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who are there, they may be taking what they can get for whatever reason.
Yeah, they're tied to the mill.
Yeah, or they may be young.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Don Gibson, whether he'd acknowledge this or not, is taking advantage of these young people who maybe don't know better that this is a dysfunctional outfit, which makes it even worse in my book, the fact that these kids are under 18 and maybe they don't know that this is not how, you know, this is not how a workplace should operate. This, mm-hmm, is not how it shouldn't be this dangerous for them to be there. They shouldn't be there at all.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and sometimes when you're that young or inexperienced, you don't know how truly dangerous the situation is that you're in.
Correct.
Because we've talked about it before on the podcast. When you're working at a legal business, you kind of assume that everything's in order in terms of safety.
Especially at that age, I think you make some big assumptions on, you know, and what you can and cannot say to your supervisor or your manager or something. Well,
even if you're even thinking about those things.
Yeah.
I mean, working in these types of environments when I was in high school, or not in factory necessarily in high school, but even in college, were you really thinking about that?
Would it cross your mind? Yeah,
but,
I know.
But to me, I kind of compare that with, went and looked at videos of this machine being used, and it is an incredibly fast and powerful machine, very open machine, very exposed. I mean, something that we're talking about full mature trees that are feet in diameter being flipped like nothing so that it can kind of cut the logs into boards. And I don't know, Jeff, like trying to wrap my head around working around that machine, it reminded me of the steam powered my dad is part of a antique tractor club, right? And they have this steam powered saw from like, you know, the 1800s. And I was surprised to see that it works very, this machine works very similarly to how that old steam powered version did in terms of just a big saw blade and a huge log firing through there. And kind of everyone, you know, if they don't know what they're doing, could get into real trouble really fast.
You know, when I looked at this story, I kind of went through a range of different thoughts. Because at first going through it, growing up in a, you know, a rural area, watching my friends on farms and working on a farm a little bit myself here and there, like you can see how some of these things, there could have almost been a level of not understanding, not appreciating, maybe ignorance would be a strong word in terms of the safety elements to it. Okay. Mm-hmm. You can see, you know, this happened. It's a sawmill. You can appreciate the inherent dangers associated with it. So I was kind of in a place where I could have almost, not that ignorance is an excuse in any way, shape, or form, but when you see OSHA inspectors coming on and you've still got teenagers flying around in fork trucks, maybe the owner Gibson here just like didn't get it. Yeah. It was somewhat ignorant to what's going on. Then you go further and you see, no, he really just didn't care.
Yeah.
Because he's been hit before.
Yeah.
And that's what gets so infuriating with these situations. And to me, it's like, what does it take for somebody in this situation to realize you're killing people?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You're killing people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about that.
Yeah. What does it take to get an injunction against
really,
somebody?
What does it take for him to just put something on the machine or tell people to be careful? That's the biggest thing OSHA was looking for. I guarantee if he would have done something, there would not be $350,000 worth of fines that he's dealing with right now. So what does it take? And when I started looking at this, OSHA can take criminal action, but there has to be a willful act by the offending company to not take action. It had to be like intentional, essentially, where they looked at the reg and they said, nah, not going to do it.
Yeah.
Now, there have been situations where owners of companies have gone to jail for OSHA violations because they turned it over to the DOJ and it did go there. Most of the time, it was construction companies dealing with falls.
Yeah.
So there are owners of construction company that went to jail because their employees were hurt on site. In the manufacturing realm, it's a little bit harder to find these situations. The two that I could find, and we're familiar with this one, was Didion Mills over in Cambria.
Yeah.
Now, there it was involved with a lot of executives basically falsifying safety documents and saying, yeah, we had all this in place. They didn't.
Yeah.
They were indicted. They're looking once this case hasn't gone all the way through to fruition, but there's six individuals there because people did die in this mill explosion. There's six individuals looking at potentially 20 years in jail.
Yeah.
Once this all comes out, we'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. The other one that came to mind or popped up was actually in 2017 as well. It was in, let me pull it up here. It was a plastics company, ABC Polymer, and a plastic extrusion. And an individual, spare the details, was sucked into a piece of equipment and died.
Mm-hmm.
Here again, OSHA filed charges. The DOJ went after him, but it was kicked down to a Class B misdemeanor, which means they paid $500,000 in fines and it went away.
Yeah.
But when you look at it, we need to have some sort of personable, when there is an individual that you can point directly at, like there is in this situation, and hold them accountable, there needs to be criminal charges because potentially, again, Anna talked about the economic reality of this situation, people are going to keep working at these facilities that this guy turns out. Mm-hmm. He knows how to make money doing it. He's probably not paying them great. And this is the job option that they have. Something needs to happen from a more punitive level for him to stop because he'll file bankruptcy and not pay this fine and go on and do it again.
Well, that's where I thought you were going in terms of what does it take OSHA or another regulatory body to stop a person from being able to do that? Because I get it. You know, if you're that type of person, it might, nothing will make you change, right? Mm-hmm. Nothing will make you change. And so we've seen the DOJ put injunctions on people where they just can't have a business anymore. And I mean, what does it really take to have an injunction against somebody like this? I get that criminal prosecution would be more of a, I guess I don't know what might be more of a detractor for people, whether it's criminal prosecution or the fact that you can't run a business or own a business anymore.
If you know you're going to go to jail because you're not keeping your employees safe, I think that is the ultimate detractor.
Yeah.
Because, I can't own a business. Guess what? My wife can.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit about this imminent danger posting, the alert that basically tells workers there's a threat. Because, Jeff, like you said, it's a sign, you know. But this seems like something that OSHA actually has where they can have a judge or have a federal court order that makes the employer eliminate the problem. So they actually have a little bit of teeth there where if there's an imminent danger, they can basically file an injunction against the machine. And maybe if there were more of these imminent danger warnings used, maybe that's another thing too, because like a stopgap in between, like before something terrible happens and you get to the criminal prosecution, the injunction. Maybe if you can just completely stop using a mission critical piece of equipment, you know, maybe that could poke some real
something,
change.
Right?
Yeah.
Something dramatic needs to happen here. Yeah. And this goes back to, I think, the core issue. And we've talked about this a couple times. OSHA is just dramatically, ridiculously understaffed.
Yeah. According to OSHA, working in a sawmill is one of the most dangerous occupations in the United States still today. I read one report and it just focused on wood product manufacturing in the state of Maine. It looked at wood manufacturing from 1987 to 2004 and showed that workers in that industry were almost twice as likely to get injured than every other job in the state. Oof. So it's dangerous. And again, when you have young workers, they likely never heard of that. Likely had no exposure to that kind of information. All right. Our next most popular story as I struggle to navigate a Apple laptop. Tesla's first electric pickup rolls off an assembly line. Tesla's first Cybertruck rolled off the assembly line this week, almost 2 years behind schedule. But things happen. The company announced the achievement in a tweet that said, "First Cybertruck built at Giga Texas, with workers swarming the truck." When CEO Elon Musk unveiled the truck in 2019, the automaker said it would start production in 2021. But it did admit that making the Cybertruck would be a whole new animal for the car maker. Musk said, quote, "It takes time to get the manufacturing line going. And this is really a very radical product. It's not made in the way the other cars are made. So let's see." Well, Jeff, we're still kind of in let's see mode, but were you surprised by the photo they posted? It was a very obstructed view of the Cybertruck.
Intentionally, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know,
or because it didn't have like wheels?
I could imagine. I think I've referenced the movie Gung Ho before, when just sort of trying to churn out as many as they can, and guy drives it for like 3 seconds and the wheels fall off. He's like, "Man, handled great." You know, yeah. So maybe, I don't think it's that dramatic, but maybe some of that going on, mm-hmm. No cutting the corners. Here's the thing. I have always, when I looked at this, I thought it was super ugly. I didn't like the way it looked, but you know, I started looking at it a little bit more and they call it a truck.
Okay.
It's not really a truck.
No.
I mean, it's got the bed, you know, that you can put stuff in and all that. Mm-hmm. It's got the rugged suspension and all of that. It's really a different type of vehicle. It's not even really an SUV with the way that it's engineered.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking through some stuff on the site and I came across this picture. I don't know if we can throw it up there or not. But when you look at this image, and it's basically got the Tesla Cybertruck out in the woods. It's mm-hmm. got kind of a pop-up tent on the back of it.
Yeah.
You see what people could use it for. I could see a demographic that eats this up.
Jeff loves it.
Niche.
I do not love it. I'm just saying, if they market this to a specific demographic, a certain group, because it's not going to compete with the Lightning. It's not going to compete with the Silverado. But if you take this as a, I wouldn't even call it a truck. I think that's where they screwed up from the start. I wouldn't call it a truck. I don't know what exactly you would call it. A utility vehicle.
Yeah, it's closer to an SUV.
A unlimited potential type of camping vehicle. I don't know, whatever you want to call it. But when I saw this and you put it out in that setting with some of the different things you can put on it, and it's an electric vehicle, they're also talking about this having like a 500-mile range potentially. That's more than the Lightning. That's more than even what GM is looking to do with the Silverado when they bring that out next year. I could see a certain group gravitating to this if they can keep the price point, like they also talked about, in that $40,000, $45,000 range. I don't know. I wouldn't buy it. I don't think it's going to compete with those guys who want a pickup truck. But there might be a market out there if they can get past some of the other challenges they've had in the course of rolling it out, like, you know, breaking windows and stuff.
So you think this is the replacement for, like, everyone that's hashtag van life out there, all the people that are converting box trucks into running apartments?
Do you remember when Subaru Outbacks were super popular because everybody wanted to throw on their Birkenstocks and, like, get out in the woods?
You could see it being, like, a
Jeff,
similar
you don't wear wave. Birkenstocks in the woods.
I don't know the specific demographic that Jeff is picturing right now.
But you do it too. Yes, you do.
I mean, like,
yes, you do.
It is just like it is a small window or a small hole. They
I don't
got a
think
thread.
So. I don't think so. I think there's more and more people who'd be open minded to the potential application. The look is going to take something to get over, but I think they would embrace that because it is so weird and different. Yeah. When you look at all these people who are trying to do some of this stuff like living off grid and other things like that, this could be in their wheelhouse. Yeah.
Jeff has never read Into the Wild. Like, I think that's the demographic you're thinking of. You're thinking of the demographic of like hipsters that buy $5,000 worth of camping equipment, get out in the woods and realize they don't like mosquitoes. Like, you know,
100%. And you can sell them this. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
Talking about the people building $20,000 mud houses, and they're like, this is amazing. Yeah, until it rains.
Yeah.
Don't go knocking yurts, Jeff.
It's not a yurt, David.
Is a beautiful structure.
It's not a yurt. I'm talking about, what do they call it, with the straw and the mud?
Yeah.
A mud hut?
There's a name for the material, though, and I can't remember what it is. Somebody look that up, please. Yeah.
Well, okay, so Anna, once all these Cybertrucks are carefully parked back in parents' garages throughout the nation, what are we going to do with the Cybertruck?
Man, I'm like, normally Jeff is such a wet blanket, and then today all Tesla had to do was like CGI some trees in the background. Right?
have a nice looking cookout on the back of a Cybertruck, and he's like, I'm in.
Yeah, let's take this thing camping.
There's no meat in there. It's all vegetables. Yeah. Typical.
All right, Jeff, let's move on in a different direction away from your stereotypes. I don't know about this thing. First of all, to your point, I'm not sure that Tesla's like strategy for competing with all these new EVs coming on the market, if they really have time to monkey around with a niche product. That's just my opinion. But I'm also very interested to see what happens once deliveries of the Cybertruck begin to take place, because when Elon Musk says, we'll see, and he refers to the design as radical and that the way that's being made is unique, it wouldn't surprise me, I guess, if we saw some quality problems.
Are you saying that it's odd for Mr. Musk to kind of pump the brakes a little bit?
It kind of is. Usually he's way on the other side of it. Mm-hmm. And you know, first of all, Tesla has been plagued with quality problems for years. Mm-hmm. The Model 3 has been in production since 2017, and it still got absolutely blasted last year by Consumer Reports on reliability. The 22 model has had 10 recalls already. There's been talk, you know, of many Teslas having quality issues like paint problems, leaking, build issues, software problems, all that stuff. So...
Growing pains.
But
they are.
You do wonder, because this model is so different from the others that Tesla's producing, like, do any of the things that they've learned to date really apply?
Yeah.
At least to the exterior, you know, it's like, so then I wonder, like, are you just treating this like any other startup? Because it sounds like it's a completely novel product.
Yeah,
and a completely novel manufacturing process. He has said that, you know?
Yeah.
You know, there's some evidence that there's been a lot of problems behind the scenes that haven't been widely publicized. So Edmunds reported just last month on the contents of what it referred to as leaked documents out of Tesla, where this was last year, that its engineers were very concerned over problems with leaks, handling, general noise, vibration, harshness. The report said that an alpha version of the truck had to be hand sealed. And moreover, that parts of the vehicle did not have a clear path to sealing, a problem they blamed on the vehicle's shape, which is pretty much the same as it was since they rolled out the prototype of that. They blasted, again, this was last year, but it was just last year. They blasted its braking ability. They identified generally poor ride quality, suspension problem that they suggested would require a complete suspension redesign. So, you know, it just seems like that's in the world of like starting from scratch auto, like that's pretty recent. And those are big problems. So you wonder.
Yeah, looks cool, but it can't stop.
Yeah, so like exactly, like in typical Elon Musk fashion, like is this vehicle being pushed to market and then they wind up fixing an array of problems that crop up once it's already in the hands of its customers? I mean, if anyone's going to do that, it's Tesla, right? Yeah. So I will be interested to see. I'm not saying that this is for sure. Maybe it's going to be a great place to spend your summer vacations. If you just get a state parks pass and you just take it out there and you explore, Jeff.
This is a great thing to do on your year off.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Like, you know what? I'm going to take a break. A gap year break.
Take a gap year between college and starting your career. Take this thing out and then just see if it falls apart.
Yeah. Mom, I took my Cybertruck out to the wilderness and I fell in love. Here's my new wife. Are we talking about cob houses when it comes to, okay.
Yeah, right. Cob, but there's a different, there's another word for
it. Earthen structures constructed out of a mixture of clay, sand, and straw, perhaps in an adobe style.
That's what I was thinking of. Cob. I don't know. There could certainly be other options.
Is it possible that Tesla has transitioned so far away from startup mode to legitimate automaker that maybe kind of trying to go back to some of its bootstraps roots has proven more difficult than they expected?
You know, this is getting too easy. Let's launch.
Bootstraps.
Well, I mean, Tesla was the innovator that was breaking the mold and doing everything differently, but now they kind of have it down to a process. So to kind of try to go back and be like, hey, we've done it once before, we could do it with the Cybertruck. Maybe they sort of, they're too far removed from what that entailed. You know, it's kind of like, when you try to transition from startup to grow, scale the business, and it, you know, maybe, you know, different leadership teams are in place, maybe different personalities are there where it's like, no.
Well, I think one of the things working in their favor is I don't think they'll have to worry about scaling this one up too much.
They got time.
I think that they'll be right in their wheelhouse with producing fewer models.
I think to pre-order it, you only have to reserve it for like $100.
Yeah.
So, I mean, let's reserve a couple. Yeah. You know?
Should we see, just go, see what happens?
Yeah. Let's go have some post-podcast drinks.
Okay.
And then like just enough to be like, you know what?
Yep.
Let's all get matching Cybertrucks.
Yeah. And I will make some like fruit skewers and we will just get out there, man.
No
like,
meat though.
Yeah. No meat.
I'll go hunt some.
Is it called a clam or clam house?
That I'm not familiar.
Anyone? Okay, no. I mean, honestly, producers Eric and Alex might just be throwing anything up there and just seeing if I'm going to say it. And it's possible. Like, does anyone know a clam house? A couple of things that I looked up about this I found interesting. So Tesla just recently, like yesterday, said that the Cybertruck is going to be the first truck less than 19 feet long that has four doors and a more than 6 foot long bed. Now, why that is very important, so it can actually fit in most garages. There's a huge problem with other trucks fitting in 20-foot long garages. For example, Ford's F-150 Lightning is 19.24 feet long with a 5.5-foot bed. So struggles in the garage and still has a smaller bed. So if Tesla continues to kind of like fix some of these problems, it could really stand out. Also, just remember that Tesla originally said that this truck was going to range from $40,000 to $70,000, if everyone can remember that. And when you're competing against trucks that start at $100,000, that is an attractive price point, absolutely, particularly for the, lifestyle of Jeff's description. Later, the company did remove the prices from the page. So I guess we'll kind of see what that comes out
at. What is the price point?
Another quote from Tesla. Tesla said that Cybertruck is going to, quote, break a lot of boundaries technologically and architecturally.
It's going to break a lot.
It just, to me, this is, it reminded me of last week. It seemed like another week, another kind of joke that went too far. You know, last week it was the sex bomb hypersonic vehicle. And this, because to me, I still look at that Cybertruck and I still think it's a joke. Like when you look at the design, it doesn't look real. It looks like something that looks really cool in a sci-fi movie. Yeah, and then when you see it in real life in like a museum, you're like, oh yeah, no, the prop department did a really good job, but not an up close, not an up close vehicle. Musk also says that it should feel bigger on the inside than it looks on the outside, which could be a differentiator as well in terms of being more spacious is a truck or crossover or whatever it winds up being or competing against. All right, our next most popular story this week. E-bike manufacturer VanMoof declares bankruptcy. Bankruptcy has pressed the brakes on a company that won design awards for its minimalist electric bikes. Though the industry wasn't blindsided as the Amsterdam-based company struggled to meet demand and fix bugs in the app. So it wasn't a shock because there were a lot of bugs in the app powering the service. The company was founded in 2009 by brothers Taco and Thies Carlier, who made a joint post about the bankruptcy on Monday. The company sells its bikes online and has retail stores in more than 20 cities around the globe. It's unknown how this bankruptcy is going to impact these foreign operations, but the company wants to keep them running as usual. The company sold some 200,000 bikes that are almost theft-proof, with digital locks, built-in alarms, and GPS tracking. If a bike is stolen and the company couldn't track it down in 2 weeks, they'd give you a new one. It looks like VanMoof is possibly another COVID casualty as demand spiked during the pandemic and the company really struggled to keep up with demand. What's worse, particularly for customers, is that the company makes most of its own components, so average bike shops can't service them. Bankruptcy trustees are trying to sell off the assets, but questions remain about whether or not anyone's going to want them. Jeff, is this e-bike too proprietary to be to keep alive?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, I think when I first saw the headline, I was surprised because there's been so much growth and popularity of these e-bikes and stuff like that. When you start digging into it a little bit, you can kind of see how somebody was maybe going to fall to the wayside. And the reality is they're not out yet.
Yeah.
I mean, they're in bankruptcy. Somebody may be coming in and see a business model that they can execute here. A couple of things that stood out to me, I was doing some research. 240% increase in sales between 2019 and 2021 in electric bikes.
Holy cow.
Globally. I mean, huge market growth. What that resulted in is this company getting over $180 million in private equity funding. Okay. I mean, so they were the most well-funded electric bike company on the planet, according to them. Okay. Yeah. They even admitted that. So in looking to expand, it seems like they went way too fast. They tried to go global. They went into the U.S., and in the meantime, they were still selling bikes between $2,600 and $4,000 because of a lot of these digital features that nobody else really focused on as much as they did. Mm-hmm. However, the average price of an e-bike with all of this ramp up dropped down to like $1,800. So they were a lot more expensive. The biggest global market for e-bikes, Asia. Mm-hmm. They're not typically going to pay as much for something that might be viewed as more of a basic mode of transportation, more of a little bit of a commodity type item potentially because of the growth.
Yeah.
So I think that put them into a much more exclusive area that they could really target their products. You look at the US and you have people like Trek also coming out with very popular electric bike models at a lower price point.
Yeah.
So they had a really strong niche there kind of in the Netherlands. They wanted to expand. I think they just got a lot of money. They grew way too fast. And you brought up a good point too in terms of they were difficult to fix and repair.
Yeah.
So I mean there was a lot of things sort of stacked against them that just couldn't get past yet.
Well, it's a closed system. So that's why I struggle for people to find value unless they're willing to kind of take it all on. And it just seems really risky to me. Jeff kind of talked about scaling too fast because you know what? This is a beautiful business for the Netherlands. And they probably could have grown slowly in the Netherlands and maybe carefully selected a couple of markets that they also slowly matured in. But by going too fast, maybe they made some misses. And I don't know, they just kind of, for raising $180 million, I don't know, with the technology like this and the proprietary components going into it, that's going to dry up fast.
Yeah. I mean, we saw that with other higher end fitness equipment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know this isn't quite the same as fitness, but you know, it's on the same scale, I would say. Yeah. And you know, some of the tech features about around security that VanMoof seems to be pioneering, you know, are some of those actually a barrier to their success in the end? You know, the article didn't quite come out and say that, but I do think it sort of hinted at it, that buyers are perhaps frustrated with the proprietary nature of that technology.
Yeah.
And one, as you mentioned, is from a repair standpoint, because if you can't access that widespread existing network of bike repair shops, like you're basically being held hostage by your OEM. We saw that work out not great in automotive. And so I think that's certainly an impediment, right? At least in the early years, and especially if you're buying that bike here, knowing that the headquarters of the company is in a different country, you know?
And maybe that's just ship parts.
Well, maybe, yeah. And, you know, and that, you know, that was a challenge for Tesla, I know, in the early years too, as they were getting on board, people were concerned about how they would handle repairs and how far they'd have to go to get their vehicle fixed. And then secondly, that characterization that, bike owners were facing severe restrictions without their app. I think that can also be seen as an issue for some buyers. I mean, again, to Tesla, like it's very cool technology, but you've heard about that with Teslas too, where people are like, I got locked out of my car. Yeah. I don't have Wi-Fi. How do I get in? And some of those things in a lot of people's brains, they just shut down and think, I don't want to deal with that. Yeah. I am comfortable with what technology exists now. I don't want to go that far. And, you know, to Jeff's point, these bikes are extremely expensive. There was a unisex two-speed bike listed on VanMoof's website that currently costs $4,000 and has a one-star rating, where one person in the comments was blasting them for not being able to repair their issue, which they described as a common problem. And yet they said that nobody from the company was responding to them. Another one-star reviewer said that they prepaid for one of these bikes, but they've been waiting for 9 months and they still have no shipping date. So beyond these issues with technology, it appears that VanMoof also either has now a cash problem or a manufacturing problem or a supply chain problem, maybe all of those things.
Yeah.
So it's not just a market issue. It's a lot, you know, compounded. So I don't know. We'll see. Maybe they will be able to sell their technology or sell their brand or whatever, but a lot of things going on there.
Maybe in a downsized version of this that was just going to keep it local in the Netherlands. So I want to talk about this proprietary smartphone app a little bit, just because to me, so for me, I've always stopped short of getting an e-bike. I'm very fascinated. You know, Ben in the office has one and he brings it in, and there's a part of me that's like jealous. And then there's another part of me that's afraid to move to the next step because like my 10 speed bike is like where I top out mechanically. You know, that's like the one thing that I know if it breaks in the middle of the road, I can actually fix and go about my business in a safe manner. Whereas I look at that e-bike and I'm like, nope, looks like a bomb to me. And I think that this digital key in particular for me was a non-starter because it's like it's impossible to unlock your bike manually without this app. And owners face severe restrictions, like you said, as over what they can do. So, I mean, like it bricks your bike. Like, could you imagine if your smartphone app didn't work and as a result, you can't ride a bicycle? I mean,
is it, or, and I'm not contradicting. I'm just wondering, does it brick the whole thing? Could you still pedal it?
Well, not if
you can't take it.
Yeah. Not if it's locked. Okay. You know, it's like, that's what I said. Like worst case scenario, you can't even get it, like ride it.
Okay.
But like, I mean, otherwise you just have a $4,000 really heavy regular bike.
Oof.
But that would be infuriating.
Really heavy regular bike.
Yeah. It was called the most innovative bike. The most innovative bike company in the most bike focused nation. To me, it was also a little bit of reinventing the mousetrap, where we talk about engineers kind of not scope creep necessarily, but putting too much, going too far. However, the family is very intriguing. You know, it's a pair of brothers, Taco and Tease. They come from a family of innovators. And I listened to this podcast kind of about where they came from. Their dad was one of those guys that wanted to take everyday things and just innovate them a little bit, you know, like just, which is why I could understand how they landed on the bike and just wanted to make it a little bit better, but maybe went too far. I do have to talk about their claim to fame before the bike, right? So they had a smashing success designing machinery that automatically attached wristbands at events. That was their first claim to fame. Oh. It's like, you know, last time we went into a concert, it was a Milky Chance Amazing Concert. Missed the intro, but you know. And you have to like wait for the metal detectors, then scan your ticket, and then get your wristband and show your ID, even though you're like, come on, bud, like 20 years ago, maybe. But so I found it interesting that there was this machine that, you know, would automatically put on a wristband. Their other claim to fame was a beer token machine. Jeff, this was a machine that you would essentially put money in to get your beer tokens to exchange for beer, right?
Okay.
I mean, I don't understand the application. Maybe it's something where like you can't actually exchange cash, or maybe it's like at a venue you need to have a drink chip to actually get it.
Hey, if somebody paid them for it, that's mm-hmm. awesome.
It makes the line go way faster.
Yeah, they had like 750 of these, right?
Okay, I can get that.
But there is a really cool story, Anna, as to when they first had the prototypes out at a venue, right? So the prototypes stop working, mm-hmm. and there are lines of people behind them. Do you know how they fixed them? They went inside the machines, sat inside the machines with a laptop tied to the interface so it could tell them that, oh, okay, they bought 11 tokens for $22. So, and then as soon as the transaction went through, they would drop the tokens down through the little slot. And I'm just like, all right, that's a really cool story of like trying to get a prototype off the ground. And, you know, they wound up having success there and then wound up biting off more than they could chew with Van Moof. But it seems like a really cool family, a really innovative pair of brothers that I'm sure we'll go on to do other really interesting things. But
See, I don't think the story's over. I think there will be somebody who grabs onto this. So I don't think they missed it. I just think they went too far too fast.
Yeah. Okay. Well, our most popular story this week. Russia seizes control over Carlsberg Danone despite impending sales. On Sunday, Russia seized control on a pair of major food and beverage manufacturers, including a Danone subsidiary and a local brewer owned by Carlsberg. According to Reuters, President Vladimir Putin signed a decree that said foreign-owned stakes in Danone and Baltika breweries would be put under, quote, temporary management of the Russian government. What is odd is the timing, as both Carlsberg and Danone were in the process of selling their stakes to Russian interests. In a statement, Carlsberg seemed to be taken off guard, noting that the presidential decree occurred without any information from Russian authorities. Baltika is a significant brewing company in the area, with some 30% of the market share and 8,400 employees. In March 2022, the Carlsberg Group announced plans to exit Russia and had an agreement to sell the Russian business that was signed on June 23rd, 2023, just a few weeks ago. Danone last October started the process to transfer control of its essential dairy and plant-based business in Russia, and everything was progressing according to plan. According to Reuters, the deal would have led to a potential $1.12 billion write-off for the food manufacturer, but, you know, they want it out. Despite ongoing uncertainty, several major manufacturers are still doing business in Russia, including Heineken, Nestle, Stryker, and Unilever, just to name a few. Following the presidential decree, no one knows what to expect next. Jeff, how temporary do you think this new management is going to be?
This is weird because there is somewhat of a historical precedence in terms of these companies operating in foreign areas during time of war. Mm-hmm. Reminded me of a couple of books. I've actually mentioned them both here on the podcast, but you know, Red Notice. We've all read that one by Bill Browder. In terms of, if you want to see what Putin wants to do when he wants to take over a company, it's pretty scary what he can do. Now, these are global companies here, so the footprint is different.
Anyone that's still in Russia needs to read Red Notice. Yeah. And I think that would just really help maybe move things along.
Yeah, it's quite a story. The other one I thought of was The Arsenal of Democracy. Again, that's the book about Ford during World War II. And there was a situation there where basically Germany and Hitler just took over, in this instance, the Ford plant. just said, no, this is ours now. We're going to use it to build tanks. And not much Ford could really do about it. They got the plant back afterwards. But again, that was a situation. It was a global war. It was opposition sides. There was a war front essentially right where these factories were. They were targets. This is unique in the fact that he's looking at two companies that have global footprints and were trying to get out of Russia. The things that came to my mind right away was an article we ran earlier in the year from the AP talking about how difficult it is actually for some of these companies to leave because Russia's seeing this going on. They don't want to lose all of this potential taxing revenue and everything else that they can get from these companies. So they're putting stuff on there like a quote unquote, voluntary 10% departure tax that goes directly to the government and an understanding that companies would sell at a 50% discount. I believe the article said something like Danone's taken like a 50% cut, basically a $1 billion hit on this. And I think a lot of other companies are too. So they, at first you want to be really harsh on some of these companies for sticking around, but then you can kind of understand, look, these are food companies. They're providing a resource to the people of Russia. It's not their fault that they're being led by a maniac. So it's a really difficult situation. It's not surprising Putin would be so impatient, especially if he was potentially going to lose out on money that he can get from going a more nefarious route. It's going to be very interesting to see how this continues to play out and the impact that this has on them when the Ukrainian situation is over, whenever that may be. The other thing that you can always look at too is they are hemorrhaging money right now. There's a lot of assets, foreign assets that were frozen as a result of this conflict. This could be a money grab situation too.
And retaliation.
So, yeah.
No, it was some of the numbers that I saw in terms of what these companies were doing, Anna, was kind of shocking to me. And I was also kind of shocked. I don't know. Where do you stand in terms of some of these businesses that are staying in Russia kind of describing themselves as an essential business? And then sometimes I see what they're selling and I'm like, I don't know how essential that is.
Yeah, I think, you know, as Jeff said, it is a little bit more complex below the surface than we would like to view it. You know, it's not exactly a black and white situation.
Yeah, you don't just pull the ripcord.
Right. You know, it'll be interesting to see what this does, this situation specifically to some of those other businesses. Because there are still Western companies doing business in Russia. There's like 600 some, I think, that are still operating. So I read an interesting report where Jeff Sonnenfeld, who is a senior professor at the Yale School of Management in the U.S., and they've been tracking all this business activity in Russia since the start of the conflict. He believes that after this raid, a lot of the businesses that are still there, the Western ones, will start running for the hills. And so the interview was published in the EU Observer, and Sonnenfeld referred to the actions by Russia as the punishment for vacillating, which I thought was interesting. He talked a little bit about, you know, how maybe this wasn't as strategic so much as Putin's mob mentality and just having to send a message, whatever, you know. But he said they should have seen it coming. He said they were naive. He added that he wouldn't be surprised if Unilever, Benetton, PepsiCo, some of these high profile brands were not the next in line for these asset grabs from the Putin regime. So that's interesting to see what will happen next. He said that this should cause a stampede, quote, stampede to the exit. And it's ridiculously risky and foolish for them to stay there at that point. Also adding that it's going to be next to impossible for them to get their money back by any kind of legal means because Putin will absolutely not play ball. So it really goes to show, I think, what incredibly precarious positions these companies have always been in since the start of this. And, you know, that's not to mention, like you said, their tax dollars really funding this conflict. I think certain companies did justify staying there because they said they were providing, you know, basic food and hygiene items to the Russians, people that were not responsible for what Putin's regime was doing. And even companies like Unilever have gone on record and they've said it's not straightforward for us to leave because we know that our business is going to be taken by the Russian government if we do. And that might put them in an even more advantageous position. It's very hard to know what their true objective is in the, you know, in this case, but it is becoming clear that they could lose their assets, whether they decide to make that exit or whether Putin just potentially makes that decision for them and just takes their stuff anyway. So it does seem like we will probably see some more multinationals finally pulling the plug here, because I don't think they have a choice. I think he's coming for them.
Well, and I guess who's to blame when it comes to both Carlsberg and Danone said that they believed they were acting in good faith with the Russian government. But when you're dealing with someone like President Putin, there's no acting in good faith.
I know, but I think that, you know, in their defense, and, you know, who knows, maybe they were out for the money, but in their defense, they're looking at this like, if we leave, we are just handing everything over.
Yeah.
But if we stay, we can at least continue to produce food, soap, all the stuff that we make, and sell it to the Russian people that they need that, you know? Mm-hmm. So you can see why some companies decided, even though it was a very tricky and scary and risky situation, that they were going to stay.
And I understand that some people are using some of the companies use the argument of wanting to protect their employees as well. But Jeff, I think when you are working with such an unstable government led by such an unstable man, that like at some point, the best thing you can do to protect your employees and your business is to separate yourself as swiftly as possible with. And I think, you know, Danone was obviously trying to do that as fast as possible, willing to take almost a $1.2 million or billion dollar hit just to get out of there. But I mean, kind of not fast enough.
Well, there's two things too that come up here. First of all, if you look back, I mean, we talked about this a lot, probably a dozen years ago or so. It was all the talk was about investing in the BRIC countries, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Russia being a big one. And that's why all these companies fled there. Now they're starting to reap the benefits of what was an open and very prosperous economy. So there is a lot of infrastructure that was invested there and is on the ground. So you can, again, appreciate that. The other bigger part of this is there is no way a rational, successful business person can understand the thinking of a thug.
Yeah.
And that's what Putin is. Yeah. There's no rational there. They're trying to do this the right way because that's the way you do business. That's what common sense normal people do. You're dealing with, again, a gangster.
Yeah. Dealing with a madman. And a lot of it, in a sense, has already happened before. Danone, just some numbers again, largest producer of dairy products in Russia with $3 billion in revenue last year, just in that area alone. Baltika did $1.6 billion in sales, right? That is a lot of money that they want to nationalize. Maria Shajina, probably butchered the name. Sorry, Maria. She's from the International Institute of Strategic Studies. She says the redistribution of wealth that is happening now is very reminiscent of the 1990s when all the oligarchs emerged. And she also looked at who's going to get these assets, right? Baltika was given to Yakub Zagrev, the nephew of Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov, and known terrible person across the globe. Alina Rybakova, and Danone is being given to Putin's friend, Tamaraz Bolayev. So again, just taking the keys, handing them to friends and supporters and nationalizing them is exactly what happened in the 90s, just creating a whole new roster of oligarchs. Alina Rybakova, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute, said some similar things. It's the quotes that you pulled, Anna. She said the risk reward is no longer there for foreign companies. The more one waits, the more likely they are to lose everything. Foreign companies are being taken hostage. But at this point, I don't know what you can do to make sure you don't lose everything. You know, I mean, we've seen these companies in particular were trying to get out with crazy losses. I don't know what it's going to take to get out. And
yeah, you needed to have contingencies in place like McDonald's did, essentially, in order to really pull out without being unscathed. And I'm sure they still lost a lot of money, too.
All right. Well, before we move on to, in case you missed it, the stories that maybe weren't as popular, but still stand to make a big impact on the industry going forward, we have another word from our sponsor. And just a reminder, BigCommerce provides modern e-commerce technology that works with your existing systems. CRM, OMS, ERP, no problem. Whatever existing business tools and technologies you use today, BigCommerce can integrate using pre-built one-click integrations or customize your automation with its APIs. Make the move to BigCommerce today. let's make our move to, in case you missed it, the stories that maybe weren't as popular on the websites, but still stand to make a big impact on the industry going forward. And I'm going to start with you. What is your, in case you missed it this week?
Sure. So I picked the story titled Tornado Ravaged Plant Reopens Nearly 5 Years Later. And it was about a 2018 tornado that hit the Marshalltown, Iowa Lennox plant. It was a manufacturing plant of HVAC equipment. All of the employees were sheltered from the storm. And last week, nearly 5 years later, Lennox finally finished renovations at the plant. So the new $200 million facility has about 1 million square feet of manufacturing and office space. They invested in upgraded infrastructure, more automated equipment, even a museum showcasing the company's history of innovation over its 128 years in business. So the grand opening was pegged as not only a celebration for Lennox, but also the entire community that was shaken up by this unexpected tornado outbreak. And I selected the story because this morning we ran a story about a Pfizer pharma plant that was heavily damaged after a North Carolina tornado. Mm-hmm. There were reports that 50,000 pallets of medicine that were stored there were strewn about the facility. The roof got ripped off. So two things. I think that it's obviously reassuring to see, you know, this Lennox story, knowing that these plants can be rebuilt after these types of events, sometimes even better, and then get back up and running. Alternatively, I would add that more extreme weather events are occurring more regularly now due to climate change. And obviously, we have some changes to make to offset those carbon emissions. But also, back to the aforementioned concrete emergency management plans within your plants. Make sure that you have that, because the thing with these wild weather events now is there's just not as much time to prepare for them. Sometimes mm-hmm. they're very unexpected, and sometimes in regions that don't have those types of weather events are having them now.
Right.
This latest tornado at Pfizer hit in the middle of the day. Luckily, no one was injured. There's a right way to handle these, and let's make sure we're doing that as well.
Well, and it was significant damage at that Pfizer plant. Mm-hmm. I was kind of shocked by what happened there. And while this plant, the Lennox plant in Iowa, is a great sort of risen from the ashes story, there's also that 5 year number where, in terms of, I mean, that is HVAC equipment and how that might have impacted the supply chain. I mean,
mm-hmm. and it did, yeah.
Pfizer mm-hmm. is pharmaceutical and an industry that's already struggling with supply chain problems. Jeff, your thoughts both on Lennox coming back online in Iowa and what happened at Pfizer this week?
Yeah, I think companies are getting better in terms of responding to these things. I think there's been some good lessons learned by some prominent companies. You know, we talked about some of the things that Amazon mm-hmm. did wrong, and then when they were encountering some of the severe weather. The one I always forget too, the candle supplier.
Mayfield, yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So hopefully we are learning from that. And I think that is sort of a mantra of U.S. manufacturing. We tend to focus on maybe the 1% of that kind of draw some negative headlines, but we have to remember the other 99%, like these guys that are doing it right. You know, we've been going on some podcasts lately and talking about the manufacturing. And one of the things that I get asked about is we've got all these challenges, mm-hmm. skills gap, cybersecurity, go on and on, inflation, all that. How do we stay positive about this? Well, it's really because of the legacy of manufacturing. Mm-hmm. Going back to its origins, there's always been a problem to solve, and we figured out a way to address it. Mm-hmm. And we're continuing to do so. You know, Anna brings up carbon emissions. We're not there yet, but we're better. We're yeah. getting better, and we're going to continue to work at it. So I think this just adds to that resiliency that's just sort of in the fibers of U.S. manufacturing, and it's a great way to illustrate how we can figure out how to solve a lot of these issues that we're dealing with. Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I find both optimistic and frustrating is that it seems like we've finally started to make some real changes as an industry, and we've seen how once the industry starts making like major changes, how it can have such an immediate impact. So I find that optimistic and frustrating in that if maybe it was just taken a little bit more seriously once people started raising flags, you know, maybe we might not be in the situation.
Before they had to.
Yeah. Maybe, you know, maybe these extreme weather events wouldn't be as severe, but who knows? Well, I guess the scientists know, and yeah, it wouldn't be as bad. Jeff, what's your, in case you missed it this week?
Shocker, I picked a cybersecurity story.
What? Oh,
yeah, no. Big surprise. So I picked an article with the headline, Biden administration launches cybersecurity labeling program. So the administration and major consumer technology players launched an effort to put a nationwide cybersecurity certificate and labeling program in place The idea is to help consumers choose smart devices that are less, keyword being less, vulnerable to hacking. They're liking it basically to like the Energy Star program for appliances. Okay. So you can look at it. So there's a lot of good here. Okay. Mm-hmm. This is a great first step in terms of basically putting a sticker on a product. I don't mean to downgrade it by saying it's a sticker, but by putting an indication on a product saying, hey, we've run it through our standards. We've looked at the NIST standards and some other things. This is as good as we can get right now in keeping this secure. And basically the main things that they're looking at are a lot of internet and Bluetooth connected devices like from around the house. So they're looking at home security cameras, fitness trackers, TVs, refrigerators, smart climate control systems, all things that can get hacked into that have some personal information attached to it. Again, great first step. Here's the only thing that concerns me when I see this. Right now, David, you go out and you buy a new thermostat for your home. It's got this sticker on it. As of 2023, it's secure as well as they can possibly do. Mm-hmm. It's not 100%.
Yeah.
Okay.
But
it's better.
Yeah. But it's like driving it off the lot, right? Like as soon as you buy it, it's already obsolete.
Not that bad, but I just hope it doesn't create, and I'm optimistic that we'll continue to push this forward. I just want it to create a false sense of security because the hackers continue to get smarter. Device and technology changes. So the need to constantly make sure that this device is still secure going forward, it has to be a bigger part of this program as well.
Yeah.
It's great to make device manufacturers, and we talk about secure by design at the component level and at the plant floor device and technology level. This takes it to the home application, which is important. Great first step. Let's keep it going. Let's make sure that people can upgrade, whether it's security standards, and that we're being educated on how to keep this stuff secure going forward, not just being over-reliant on a label.
Well, and I like the comparison to Energy Star because, Anna, it reminds me of when Energy Star became a thing, right? Everyone started switching appliances and thinking they were going to see immediate and dramatic impacts on their power bills, right? And they just weren't seeing it. And, you know, when you would talk to technicians, when they'd come in, they're like, yeah, and I mean, and actually the technicians at the time, they're just like, yeah, that's just a sticker. It really doesn't mean anything. But it wasn't as dramatic of an effect, but it was incremental. It was moving it forward. And now we're starting to see some like really efficient appliances come out as to whether or not they actually last more than 5 years. We'll see. But I don't know. Do you think that this label is going to lull people into a false sense of security? Because for me, I'm hoping that it at least when you're looking to buy a device, maybe you buy something with this designation just because it at least affords you a little bit more protection.
Yeah. And I guess I would look at it from more the tech provider side, the manufacturer side. You mentioned secure by design. Like if you have this, like all of them want this sticker on their product. So it gives them something to work towards to make an effort to make these more resilient. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think that in general, at least it's going to be a boon to all the end users in that sense because they will get a better product that's more secure.
And ideally, it helps people just start thinking more about security. So,
all right. My, in case you missed it, Seth, who is actually watching us live, Seth, it's always great to see you. He says, great insights from all of you on the wild situation in Russia.
Oh, thanks,
just
Seth.
Bananas there, isn't it, Seth? Well, my, in case you missed it, this week is about a weird robot. So, Jeff, big surprise. Chipotle is testing Autocado.
Had to be done.
An avocado processing prototype.
No other name.
That can, I mean, it just, it's too perfect. It's too perfect.
Nailed it.
Chipotle, if anything, has just, you know, 100% win rate on the naming. So this avocado processing prototype can hold up to 25 pounds of avocados and cut the amount, that amount of them. It, it can cut them.
Cuts a lot of them.
You got the Autocado.
And it cuts the time.
Yeah. We're just gonna start over about the Autocado. Basically, holds a bunch of them, and it cuts the time that it takes to make guacamole in half, which, if you've ever made guacamole, it can be extensive. Autocado also makes the workplace safer. This is one thing that I found shocking. According to OSF Healthcare, avocado-related injuries, which are legitimately known as avocado hand. Real thing, Jeff. Real thing, Jeff.
All right.
For the listeners, Jeff was struck by the term avocado hand. It sends 9,000 people to the emergency room each year. Whoa. Which seemed high to me. Seemed high. You know, it's
trying
it's
to get that pit out.
Is I don't know. Happening? I think maybe between the pit or like slicing it in the peel. I don't know. But
I mean, I could see how you could definitely cut your hand opening an avocado, but that seems like a lot to go to the emergency room.
It's you know, it's really dire.
Jeff
and
go.
You should check out some of the photos out there. It's enough that you know iStock has images for avocado hands, and they're grim. They are grim. Chipotle says restaurants in the U.S., Canada, and Europe will use 100 million pounds of avocados this year. So when you talk about using avocado and more precision processing techniques, we're talking about saving millions of dollars in food waste. I like this because it is a great story about embracing innovation, also working through bugs and solving problems that Chipotle has with both labor and waste. This is what we talk about when it comes to automation, having real world impact. And Chipotle, for all the kind of guff they receive as a result of taking some of these big swings sometimes, I think they're actually starting to see some real benefit from it. At first, again, I thought it was a gimmick like Chippy, if you remember that one. Mm-hmm. Chippy was the robot that, if you can believe it, made chips. But that wound up working as well. One thing I was curious about, and I wanted to ask you guys, and I'll start with you, is remember how in COVID, like ghost kitchens became a thing?
Yeah.
And I can get on board with ghost kitchens because either way, I'm ordering food and it's being delivered. So I really don't ever see the ghost kitchen, right? Not mm-hmm. that I would ever see a brick and mortar place, if I was getting delivery, but do you think fully automated kitchens will work? Do you think that, and I get it, like a lot of these restaurants already have kiosks and things to further automate them when you walk in, but mm-hmm. will patrons like go to a fully automated kitchen to buy lunch?
Yeah, I think someday they will. Yeah. You know, obviously there's a lot to work out between now and then, and they would need to be well monitored.
Yeah.
But some of those steps that take place in the like the plating and finishing steps are just really low value add, like labor intensive tasks. This guacamole thing is awesome. Like mm-hmm. really, you know, like this is exactly what robotics is perfect for. Mm-hmm. These jobs that people don't want to do. Chipotle has a massive need. You know, would you rather your Chipotle close at 5:30 every day because they can't get anyone to cover the last couple hours of the regular hours? I mean, that's what's happening everywhere. Is
yeah.
People,
yeah.
It just, people are scaling back on their hours because they don't have the enough labor. And these are tough jobs to do. So get people in there that are doing the stuff that really need human hands and human eyeballs on, and take the rest and give it to Avocado.
Just going to be one lone worker in there working with Chippy and Avocado.
No, that's not fair either. That person would go crazy.
Be a lonely yeah. place. No, nah, you talk to him. We're going to throw it up on the screen, but just a little example of some of the...
This is avocado hands.
Let's just say dramatic interpretations of or dramatizations of avocado hands.
That seems a bit excessive.
Right?
You got to cut all your fingers off.
You show that to 100 people, they're going to invest in avocado because there's a clear need.
Jeff Absolutely. Still wouldn't go to the emergency room.
No, you glue them back on.
He would just tape it to the other avocado hand.
Jeff, when it comes to fully automated kitchens, would you patronize them? Would you go to, you know, a completely closed box shipping container shed that you punch in a couple of numbers and get a taco?
Well, I think for me, quite honestly, I would go back to, you remember we did that story on that automated cheeseburger thing?
Yeah.
And they, I think the cheeseburger was going to cost like $8 or $9 or something, which is a little bit more than what you'd pay. So if it's going to be that much more expensive, probably not.
Yeah.
But I can definitely see the benefits, especially if it's quicker and get in and out of there. I wouldn't be averse, I guess.
Yeah.
What I would say.
In a pinch. Yeah. No. And I mean, you would almost hope that because it's automated at first, maybe because it's a novelty, it would cost more, but that cost might come down.
Yeah.
Or at least there would be that expectation for me as a customer. But where it's really going to drive people crazy is when it's a completely lights out kitchen and they still ask you for that 15 to 25% tip after you buy. Just like, who am I tipping? This has gotten out of hand. All right. Well, let's move on to our final thoughts before we get out of here this week. Anna, what is your final thought?
I got some big weekend plans. We are going to like a very intense petting zoo where you can feed goats like strawberries and things.
Oh, Okay.
Yeah.
I just thought it meant you like pet them harder.
No, well, petting. You, oh, intense petting.
Yeah.
I don't think I would pet them super hard. I think just, you know, they're. Just,
it's going to be a regular
goats are intense, though.
With strawberries.
Oh, I know.
You got to hold like the feet up or they'll.
I know. They're going to like chase us. That yeah. My kids will be sobbing. I don't know what's going to happen.
Is this the place that's promoting the like new herd of baby goats that they have just got from somewhere?
They did have some like hilarious like baby goat like rundowns on their website where it just looked like glamour shots of the goats and they looked cute and
yeah.
I think it's gonna be fun.
The goats are into it.
You yeah, oh, I know. That. Yeah. You got to get there early, though, because if you get there too late, then the goats are like, thanks, I've had enough.
No more round biscuits for me.
Yeah, none of that, whatever crunchy stuff is in the bag. Yeah.
Why strawberries?
Just they'll put it in like an ice cream cup?
They,
or like, yeah.
they don't do that anymore.
No?
Yeah.
They don't want the kid. Like, typically, the food isn't supposed to look good enough that the kids eat it before they give it to the goat.
Yeah, no, I
or share with the goat. Worse, oh my god!
Now I have some more to fear heading into this. I'll let you know.
I'm sorry. Please enjoy the heavy petting. Jeff, what is your final thought this week?
So I kind of screwed up. I was going to bring something in and surprise you guys to help demonstrate our new can koozie.
Demonstrate our new can koozie.
Yeah, can we zoom in on that?
For those of you who don't know how this product is used.
It's not a use. It's just the amazing application of our merchandise.
All right.
So, because I screwed that up, I'll put that off till next week. But it did get me thinking a little bit about, Tuesday after softball, we had somebody, they had like a tailgate, had a bunch of leftovers. Mm-hmm. Tailgates are tough packing a cooler because you have a diverse collection of tastes and interests and you have to satisfy that. So it was totally fine to obviously bring in like just a hodgepodge of stuff. Mm-hmm. No issues there. But there were a couple of beers in there. Mm-hmm. There was one beer, I should say, that I can't do it.
Okay.
Cannot do it. So it was the only time somebody's after you lifted a beer out of a cooler and said, how about this one? I said, no.
Oh.
And I know I'm going to take some flack for this, but it was a Busch Light.
Oh.
Like, I can't do Busch Light.
Oh, man. Mm. What do they call
it? And it's not a political thing. It is merely the fact that it was the super cheap beer in college and just had enough. Cannot do
too many bad memories.
Yes. Oh, man.
Cannot do any more Busch Lattes.
Busch Lattes. Thank you. I was lost on that.
So what I would like to know, anybody listening, is there a beverage, if somebody pulled it out of the cooler at a cookout, tailgate, after a sporting event, whatever, that you just couldn't do?
Yeah.
Let me know. We'll get one of these out to you.
Get the koozie.
Absolutely.
So you get the koozie by saying what you most definitely would never put in it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're right about
how ironic.
Well, you're right about that being a weird situation because the first one I pulled was a zero alcohol hop flavored seltzer, which was weird. It was weird. And it was like a promo. So it had like promotional materials on it. Like it was given away. It looked like a trade show.
Yeah. Nobody bought that.
And I enjoyed it because it was something I had never tasted before. But then it was like, everyone else wanted to try it. And so at least four different people tried it. Universally, it's just like, yeah, that's not for me. That's not for me. I did finish it. But then as I was finishing it, I'm like, wow, we are so post-COVID right now. We're like five guys just hit this can. And I'm like, definitely finish it. Yeah.
And then we're all wondering if Bill could finish the Long Island iced tea in a can.
Oh, man.
That was interesting.
Yeah, there were some hard times. But I mean, it was a good night. Yeah.
We really struggle here.
God, man, that buzz was so difficult. As a part of softball, you know, the hot corner was particularly hot this week. And I've taken a couple of shots, so I'm just looking forward to kind of just taking it easy for a couple of
days.
Take
a relax this weekend, yep.
Take it real easy, some ice.
So no petting zoo for you this weekend?
No, we're actually.
It goes to be way too intense for
David.
No, we're going to go up to the cottage with some family. So, I mean, I'm going to hope for relaxation and just, you know, maybe get some time on the boat, you know, escape on that kayak. Just like, wasn't there a green kayak there? Where's David? Just like, he's not coming back. But I do think there are a lot of people out there that are still running real hot, need some relaxation. I was driving to work. You know, the commute's a little different now. We're on the interstate. I talked about all the carnival equipment that I've been seeing on the roads lately.
Tons of it.
I was driving in the middle lane, the left lane, completely open, right lane, completely blocked. And some guy comes flying up on me in the middle lane. And I can, as he's flying up on me, he's already doing the hand signals. Like, he's already like, you're going to move? You're going to move? And I'm just like, and I'm trying to do it behind me. I'm like, go over, like move over. And he's still like flailing his hands. And I just like, my go-to is I wave to him. I'm just like, hi. And I was giving him the thumbs up. I'm like, hey man, yeah, I'm fine here. And he finally like won't go around me. So I squeeze into the right lane and he comes flying up next to me. And I thought, you know, he was going to be confrontational. Give me that one fingered salute. But he just looks at me and goes, man, and gives me the thumbs down. Because I was giving him the thumbs up, like, yeah, man, everything's fine. Thumbs down. Man. Just, and it was like the most aggressive thumbs down I've ever seen. So it's just, you know, if you're that guy on the road, really take this weekend and decompress. You know, yeah. Find yourself your Bush latte or zero alcohol, hemp infused, whatever it is, and just relax because, my goodness, life is too short to have such angry thumbs down in the world. All right, just a little bit of housekeeping with trivia. Last week's winner on trivia was Pete. He had this question, this question correct. You had to match the company with the Major League Baseball team uniform they have appeared on this season. The companies were Marathon, Quikrete, and Motorola. The the teams were the Cleveland Guardians, which... I apologize for maybe getting wrong last week. The Atlanta Braves and the San Diego Padres. In that order, Marathon appeared on the Cleveland Guardians. Quikrete appeared on the Braves. And Motorola appeared on the Padres. No trivia this week. Hopefully we will bring it back next week. We'll see what we get in terms of can koozie enthusiasts this week. But... before we get out of here, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You could also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. Seth, just give us that thumbs up you always give us. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IAN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. Subscribe to our daily and weekly newsletters. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. And subscribe to us on YouTube at IAN Magazine so you can join Seth, Jesse, Carrie, everyone that's in the live chat. With the competitive punning, we appreciate it every week. For Jeff Ranke and Anna Wells, I'm David Manti. This is the Today in Manufacturing podcast, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Today in Manufacturing podcast.